Hi, I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and this is Toxic Free Talk Radio, where we talk about how to thrive in a toxic world. And we do that because there are so many toxic chemicals in our lives today at this point in time. And they're in the water we drink, the food we eat, our consumer products, our homes, even in our bodies from past exposures. And on this show, we talk about how to recognize toxic chemicals, where they are in products, how to choose a non-toxic product, and how to get toxic chemicals out of our bodies and be healthy. Other ways of doing things that are not toxic and just being able to recognize the difference. So today we're going to be talking with, my guest is a toxicologist. There's a whole field of toxicology that just figures out what is toxic and what isn't. And there's processes on how they do this, standard ways of doing things. And my guest is going to tell us about some of those. His name is Dr. Stephen Gilbert. He's PhD, D-A-B-T. He's the director and founder of the Institute of Neurotoxicology in Washington State and author of a book, ebook called A Small Dose of Toxicology, The Health Effects of Common Chemicals. He has a very extensive website called toxipedia.org that is a suite of sites that put scientific information about toxics in the context of history, society, and culture. He's got a lot of information and explains things very clearly, and I'm going to have him on many, many times. So today, he's already been on once. You can go back into the archives at toxicfreetalkradio.com and listen to the other show, listen to today's show, listen to the future shows, because here you're really going to learn what this whole question about toxic things really is about. Before I introduce Dr. Gilbert, I just want to say that we're going to be talking about his book today, A Small Dose of Toxicology, and you can get that book free. It would be nice if you made a donation, but you can get that book free by going to toxipedia.org and you can also go to toxicfreetalkradio.com, and I actually have the title of his book in the description of his show, is linked to the place where you can get it for free. It's totally worth reading. Even if you just read it in little bits and pieces, you'll get so much information to understand the toxic chemicals in the world around you. Hello, Dr. Gilbert. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Deborah. Good to see you again.
Thank you. And how are you today?
Very good.
Good. So where shall we start? First, I'd like you to tell our listening audience, what inspired you to be interested in the field of toxicology?
Well, that started quite a while ago, but I was very interested in protecting children's health because I thought we exposed them to many chemicals, and we need to have better control over the chemicals we expose them to. So I was very interested in chemicals such as lead and mercury and the consequences to developing nervous system.
Good. So let's just start right out. Why don't you, I'm going to let you lead this interview. Usually the interviewer is supposed to lead the interviewee, but you know your subject so well. I'm going to let you guide us as to what you'd like to talk about. So go ahead.
Okay.
Give us a lecture. Just pretend like you're in the classroom giving a lecture.
Okay. That sounds like fun. So I thought we'd first talk about a little bit about caffeine. And I want to emphasize my book, Small Dose of Toxicology. Each chapter of the book has a PowerPoint presentation that goes with the chapter. So if you're not up for reading the book, you can just look at the PowerPoint presentations. And much of what I'll talk about today is based on the first couple chapters of the book and the PowerPoints that are associated with those chapters.
Okay, good.
But I thought we'd talk about caffeine. Are you a caffeine consumer, Deborah?
Off and on. It depends on how I'm feeling. I am a chocolate consumer, and I also understand that there are different types of caffeine. Somebody I had on the show was talking about tea, and he was saying that the type of caffeine in tea is different from the type of, in coffee and different from chocolate, and I haven't researched that, and I don't know if you have anything to say about that. But I do know that caffeine does affect your body, and I it's on my list of better to not take it.
Yeah, well, caffeine is a real interesting compound. And it's the same, in tea and coffee, it's the same type of caffeine. And caffeine is, the chemical name is 137-trimethylxanthine. Chocolate, however, has more of theophylline in it. It has a little bit different, has a dimethylxanthine instead of a trimethylxanthine in it. It's theophylline.
So does that make it better for you?
Yeah, it makes it a little bit different. You know, you don't get quite the central nervous system effects as you do with caffeine with chocolate. So it's a little bit different. But, for example, you have to be really careful with dogs, for example. If they get a hold of chocolate, it can be very toxic to dogs because they don't metabolize the theophylline very well.
Yeah. So is there a difference? We might as well just define caffeine here in terms of its differences in coming from different sources. So I know green tea has some caffeine in it, but it's not as much as coffee.
Well, actually, most tea, a lot of tea, the black teas, by weight, will have more caffeine than coffee. But we do a much better job of extracting the caffeine from coffee than we do from tea. And if you want more caffeine with your tea, you just have to brew it longer because the hot water will extract the caffeine. But with coffee, because we grind it up so small and the coffee granules have a bigger surface area, we'll extract more caffeine from coffee. So your average cup of coffee has about 100 milligrams of caffeine in it, but there's enormous variability in that.
Mm-hmm. Good.
So I think one thing to remember when thinking about caffeine is, and the really great lessons in toxicology is, how does caffeine distribute throughout the body?
Tell us about that. That's a really important
When you consume caffeine, it is absorbed relatively quickly, so your peak caffeine levels will be about 30 minutes after you consume your caffeine-containing beverage. And caffeine distributes throughout total body water. So your urine, if you go to the bathroom, your urine will have about the same concentration of caffeine as your blood does. And actually, for breast milk, will be about the same. So that's a good lesson to thinking about. If you're breastfeeding a child, you want to consume your caffeine after breastfeeding, not before, because you want to minimize the amount of caffeine that goes to the child.
Absolutely. And that's something, this whole idea of how the chemical distributes through the body, that's one of the points that toxicologists look at. That's one of the things that's important to know about a chemical that you're being exposed to, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really important property of the chemical. Like I mentioned, caffeine distributes throughout total body water, but something like lead, which substitutes for calcium, it distributes to the bone and absorbed by the bone and substitutes for the calcium that's in the bone. Compounds like PCBs, DDT, flame retardants, and a range of other compounds distribute to fats. They're fat-soluble compounds. So you have to be really aware of where a compound distributes. And the other important property is how fast it's metabolized, how fast it's changed by the body and excreted by the body. Caffeine, if you think about caffeine, if you consume your cup of coffee, how much time does it take before you're ready for a second cup? When you feel like, you know, you like a little more caffeine to boost your caffeine levels back up again? Do you have any idea, like, Deborah, when you think about you drink coffee or anybody else?
Well, I only rarely drink coffee, and I actually try not to drink coffee, and I have never been a cup of coffee in the morning kind of coffee drinker. But I drink it when I'm traveling usually because I'm in some different time zone, and
right.
And I drink it if I haven't slept well, which is usually I do sleep well nowadays, but at times when I haven't slept well and I need to work long hours, then I'll have a cup of coffee because it'll perk me up. Now, in my particular body, if I drink one cup of coffee in the morning, then it lasts me all day. That's all I want to drink is one cup of coffee. And I don't even drink a whole cup of coffee. I only drink about a half a cup of coffee.
You're somebody that's probably more sensitive to caffeine than others. Because some people can drink caffeine throughout the day or coffee throughout the day.
I know people who do that.
I know, and it amazes me because I'm pretty sensitive to it also.
And when they're not drinking coffee, they're drinking Coke or some other caffeinated beverage.
So your can of Coke will have, you know, your average cola beverage will have about 50 milligrams, about half of what coffee does, unless you're consuming Jolt or one of the high caffeine beverages. But those high caffeine containing beverages are pretty popular right now.
And I think that coffee is actually better for you to drink than a soda because you can have more control, especially organic coffee, because you can have more control over the sugar and, you know, anything else that might be put into it. We need to actually take a break right now, but we'll come right back and hear more about this fascinating subject. I actually love toxicology. This is Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and I'm talking with Dr. Stephen Gilbert, toxicologist. We'll be right back. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Gadd, and today we're talking about basic principles of toxicology with Dr. Stephen Gilbert, PhD, and he is the author of A Small Dose of Toxicology, The Health Effects of Common Chemicals, and he has a fabulous website about toxicology called toxipedia.org, which is very easy to understand. There's lots and lots and lots of information there, but it's all written in a way that I think any average person could understand it. It's not a technical website at all. It's very good. And so today we're talking about principles of toxicology. So go on, Dr. Gilbert.
So right before the break, we were talking about how fast a compound is metabolized or removed from the body. And with caffeine, and the general principle of that is called half-life. So you think of the compound gets up to, say, 10 in your blood. How long does it take to drop to 5?
Why do they do that? Why don't they just say from whatever it is to 0? Why do they do half-life?
Because you want to look at how quickly the chemical is being removed from your body. So if it's a fast metabolizer and its half-life is short, it moves out of the body relatively quickly. A compound that's got a long half-life stays in the body for a longer period of time. So it's a really good marker on how long the compound sticks around. And it has to do also where it's distributed in the body.
Okay, good.
So caffeine, for example, the half-life is pretty short. It's for most people, it's 3 to 4 hours. Mm-hmm. Although there's quite a variability in that. So you consume a cup of coffee or a can of cola, and your caffeine blood levels will rise, let's say, to 10. 3 to 4 hours later, it'll be down to 5. And you'll want to boost your caffeine levels back up if you like the stimulant effects of caffeine.
Yeah.
But there's some really important changes in that. For example, a woman that's pregnant in the second and third trimester, the caffeine half-life about doubles. So it goes up to about 7 or 8 hours, which means that your blood caffeine levels will be higher for a longer period of time during pregnancy.
And if you keep drinking the same amount of coffee as before pregnancy, then you're really getting a jolt.
You are, and your fetus is getting a jolt too, because that caffeine, and it's metabolized, quickly distribute across the placenta, so the child is basically swimming in caffeine that's metabolized during pregnancy.
So pregnant women.
And the other thing to remember
really
that's important with half-life is the child, the fetus, or the infant, from 0 to 6 months does not metabolize caffeine. So the half-life is measured in days, because all it can do is excrete it in the urine.
Wow.
So that's really important property to remember, that it's much different for a child because their liver function is not really developed yet.
Yes. Wow.
Yeah,
I didn't know that. Yeah. That is amazing. And it's making me think about other chemicals that children are being exposed to as well during that same period of time, that it would, like caffeine, it would take them longer to metabolize than an adult. And so I just think that the most critical time to not be exposed to toxic chemicals is that pregnant women should not be exposed, and newborn babies should not be exposed. And anything that people in those two groups can do to reduce their chemical exposure is well worth it. But I think that that's the most critical population to be concerned about.
I agree. I think women of childbearing age and infants and kids, it's a really important period of time. And unfortunately, they're exposed to a lot of chemicals now. So there are several studies that have been done that show that there can be over 200 chemicals, you know, industrial-based chemicals, in a fetus during development. So it's really become a greater and greater problem. And we often don't know what chemicals are in our products that we're consuming.
That's right. Well, you know, just kind of off the topic, but relevant to this, is that just last week, Target store announced that they are now having a new sustainable product program where they're going to be looking at the toxic chemicals in every single, not in every single one of their products, but they're like rolling it out category by category. So the manufacturers will now have to tell them all the ingredients, and all the products will be rated for their toxic levels at a store like Target. So I think that we're making progress with that, and I think Walmart has a program like that as well. I don't think, walking into these stores, I don't see that they're really in effect yet, but at least they're looking at this, that's how much toxic issues are coming to the fore now, that major retailers like that are having programs where they're actually paying attention to that.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think there's more efforts to do that. And Walmart was just, I believe they had a problem with some lead in some of their child products too recently. There was a study done by Washington Toxics Coalition here in Seattle that found lead in some of their products. So I think they need to do better about that. They need to really be working with the public to protect us from exposure to toxic chemicals.
I agree. And it's the work of toxicologists like you that makes it possible then for the retailers and the consumers to then understand what the toxic chemicals are and then be able to control them in and manage the risk either as a retailer or an individual in their daily life.
Yeah, and really put more pressure and encourage retailers to be more responsible and be more aware of the chemicals that might be in their products. For example, in the food industry in the Washington state, we have referendum 522 about labeling genetically modified organisms and products. So the GMO referendum 522 would require grocery stores and others to label if there's GMO in the product. And one thing, Whole Foods has just come out saying they're moving toward labeling all their GMO products now.
Well,
really great.
I think that's really good, but I'm also just have to say a place like Whole Foods, you would expect that there would be no GMO products, but if there are, they need to be labeled.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure. Well, let's go back to
I want to mention one more thing about caffeine. Some of your some of the listeners may have, when you stop consuming caffeine, get a headache from caffeine consumption.
Yeah, that happens to me.
Have you ever had that happen to you?
Yes.
Yeah, so that's a really interesting property of caffeine. And you could also, you could almost say that's a sign of drug addiction, because you can end up consuming a product to avoid the adverse effects of withdrawal from that product. So you have withdrawal syndromes from caffeine, which is a headache. And that's one reason some of the analgesic tablets will have caffeine along with analgesic in them, because a lot of headaches are caffeine-induced headaches.
Hmm.
So, to think about the caffeine and why people make money from caffeine, it's, you know, the cola and the coffee companies, it has a relatively short half-life, 3 to 4 hours. You have to keep consuming it because you can't sort of store it up. And you get a headache when you stop drinking it. It's almost the perfect compound to make money from. So, and a lot of people exploit those properties of caffeine to make a lot of money from the drinks and coffee beverages.
Yep.
It's really a fascinating compound.
It is. We need to take another break, but we will be right back. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd. This is Toxic Free Talk Radio. You can find out more about Toxic Free Talk Radio at ToxicFreeTalkRadio.com. And my guest today is Dr. Stephen Gilbert, and he's the author of A Small Dose of Toxicology, The Health Effects of Common Chemicals, and he also has a website, Toxipedia.org. And we'll be right back. Listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and my guest today is toxicologist Dr. Stephen Gilbert. He's the author of A Small Dose of Toxicology, The Health Effects of Common Chemicals, and a lot of what we're talking about on the show today is in this book, plus much, 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 much more. And you can get it, this book free, this ebook for free, by going to toxipedia.org. And I hope you'll go there and get it. If you want a link directly to the book, you can go to toxicfreetalkradio.com. And in the description of today's show, the link to the book goes right to the page where you can get this book for free. And I think every household needs to have it, study it as quickly or as slowly as you need to. But this is the basics of what you need to understand to be living in the world today where we're so exposed to toxic chemicals. Dr. Gilbert, you've done a great job with this book.
Thank you very much, Deborah. Really appreciate that.
It's the best basic toxicology book I've ever seen. So.
Yeah, thank you.
So I'm looking at the page, not the page, but the beginning of the chapter about caffeine in this book, and it tells you things like the source of this chemical, the recommended daily intake, and by the way, it says that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, advises pregnant women to avoid caffeine-containing foods and drugs, or consume them only sparingly. That's the recommendation from the FDA. So if the FDA is saying that, I think that's something to watch out for. You just have all kinds of information. So I know we advertised in the description that we're going to be talking about caffeine and, I'm looking for it in the description here, mercury and lead. So let's move on to talking about lead.
Yes, lead. Lead's a very interesting compound. So it's a heavy metal. It's widely used. It was added to paint. And we knew a long time ago that lead makes the mind give way. We knew that two millenniums ago. So we knew lead was toxic. In Europe, lead was banned from paint in the 1920s by the League of Nations, recognizing the toxicity of lead. But the United States did not ban lead-based paint until 1978, which is really tragic because that's perpetuated exposure to children. We also made the huge mistake of adding lead to gasoline, which increased average blood levels across the nation and really around the world. And there's still some areas trying to get lead out of the gasoline. So what's interesting about lead is that it substitutes for calcium. So when you're consuming lead, it goes to your body, gets into your blood, and then is sequestered in the bone. And this can have serious consequences. If you're exposed to lead while you're developing and you store lead in your bone, when does lead come out of the bone? When does calcium come out of the bone? One important time during that period is when a woman is pregnant, because the fetus is really a sink for calcium, and that lead is mobilized out of the bone to support the child. So if you're exposed to lead during development, you can pass it along to your infants and children. And the other thing to remember with lead is the absorption of lead. Because the growing child needs lead, when the child ingests lead, about 50% of that lead is absorbed. As an adult, you only absorb about 10%. So that's really important distinction to make, because a child is more susceptible to lead exposure for a couple reasons. One is that absorption factor, so 50% of the lead they ingest is absorbed, and also the hand-to-mouth behavior, because a child will have the highest blood leads when they're 1 to 3 years of age, when they're on the ground or sticking things in their mouth, and anything that has lead on it will come off, and the lead will be absorbed by the child. So that's really important fact to remember, is that the same exposure represents a much bigger dose to the child.
Yes. One thing I want to mention about a lead exposure, I'm actually going to be talking about this tomorrow. We're doing a show about scary toxic chemicals for Halloween, but there are a lot of toxic chemicals that you're exposed to in Halloween, and one of them is lead in face paint.
Yes.
And there was a study done where they actually took 10 brands of face paint and they analyzed, sent them all to the lab. This was the Campaign for Safe Cosmetics. They sent them all to the lab and all 10 of them had lead. And I'll let you say that there is no safe level for lead.
There is no safe level of lead exposure. And lead exposure should always be avoided. I mean,
always.
We are exposed to a little background lead because we've done a great job of spreading it around the environment. But there is no reason for products like face paint to have lead in them. Titanium is a great product, and most paint is switched to titanium. So cosmetics should not have lead in them. And they should remember that the child exposed to that, lipstick will have lead in it. There's been studies showing how much lipstick can have in it. And that's really detrimental because you put lipstick on your lips, obviously, and you lick a little bit of that, so you're ingesting it when you rub it off your lips. So there's just no reason to have lead in cosmetics. And I think our industries and our product developers need to be accountable for that and need to get the lead out of their products.
I completely agree. So what are some other sources where people might be exposed to lead that they could avoid?
Well, one, you have to be careful if some candies will have lead in them and the wrappings on the candies because of the lead paint. And jewelry is a really important source. They've really clamped down on that. There's been some increased laws about that, trying to remove lead from products. I know in Washington State they passed a law trying to ban lead, cadmium, and phthalates from baby toys. But there's a lot of products and a lot of toys that can have lead paint on them. There was quite a campaign to get lead out of products coming from China, for example. Because lead is a great additive. It makes things shiny. It dries quickly. So there's a lot of incentive to use the lead, but it's really detrimental to the child's development when they're exposed to lead. And that those detriments can occur at very low levels. And the Center for Disease Control, just in the last year, has lowered the blood lead action level. It wasn't as far as I'd like to see it go, but they did set a new level of lead action, really emphasizing again that there is no safe level of lead exposure.
Another source is lead in the glaze on dinnerware and also lead crystal. And those are very
good point. It can have the lead can be on the glaze in dinnerware, so you have to be careful of that. And the new technology now called XRF technology allows you to scan products fairly quickly to see if there's lead in them. And depending on where you live, there are agencies and other nonprofits that have this XRF technology and do programs where you can bring your toys and other products in to get checked for lead. Another source of lead is actually just recently is bathtubs. Old bathtubs can have lead glaze on them.
I read about that in my books, yes. And so you just need to. So what is your opinion about using the little test kits, the little swabs?
Those little swabs are good. They give you a basic indication if there's lead there, but they're not great in the sense they don't tell you how much lead is there. They don't go beneath the surface, so it just has surface lead. So if there's paint chips, that the lower paints may have lead in them. They will not check for that if it's been painted over. So they'll give you a gross indication, but they're not super reliable.
My viewpoint is that I think that they could be used as an inexpensive way to, if it tests positive, you know there's some lead there, and that's just make a decision not to use it right there. If it tests negative, then you want to go and get the other test.
If you suspect it might have lead in it, then you have to move on to a more sophisticated test like using XRF technology.
Yeah. We need to take
which has really been a great development because it's a very cheap way, it's quick, gives you feedback immediately about the product, and you can actually look at dirt also, see if there's lead in dirt or in the paint and the sills and things like that.
We need to take a break, so we'll be right back, and we're going to be talking about mercury when we come back. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadds. This is Toxic Free Talk Radio, and I'm talking with toxicologist Dr. Stephen Gilbert. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and my guest today is Dr. Stephen Gilbert. He's a toxicologist, and his website is toxipedia.org. And you can go to my website, toxicfreetalkradio.com, and look for this show. And there's a link there to his book, A Small Dose of Toxicology, The Health Effects of Common Chemicals. If you click on that link, you can get a free copy of the book, ebook. So Dr. Gilbert, let's go on and talk about mercury now. This is really fascinating to hear these different characteristics of these different chemicals. So how is mercury different from lead and caffeine?
Well, mercury is a very interesting compound also. And mercury comes in two flavors, inorganic and organic. So the inorganic, many people have experienced playing with the metal, the silver metal. Have you tried playing with that, Deborah?
In science class a long time ago.
Yeah. It's fun to play around with on the tabletop. Broken thermometers have quite a bit of mercury. Your old thermostats will have mercury in them. The old house I was in before this one had a mercury-based thermostat, which I finally got rid of. I recycled it safely. But mercury has been widely used. It's got many, many uses in the electronic industry, and it's actually a good fungicide. And it's been added to paint before, which is not a good idea, but it's a very powerful compound. Now, the thing about mercury is it turns to organic mercury, methyl mercury, when it gets into the environment. So the bacteria change the mercury, the inorganic into organic mercury, methyl mercury, and it gradually moves up the food chain from algae to bacteria and other organisms up into the fish we eat, and it's concentrated in high trophic level fish that consume other fish. So, for example, tuna, a shark, a pike will have high concentrations of mercury in them. Swordfish has generally high levels of mercury in that because it's concentrated in the muscle. So mercury goes to muscle and also the central nervous system. So it's stored there and not in fat and not in bone, but in muscle. So it's very hard to get rid of from the fish. So we learned about mercury. The first incident where we really came aware of this was in Minamata in Japan in the 1950s. And this caused really tragic exposure and great consternation to the population there, caused fetal deformities and really retarded development. So the question has been lately is how little mercury, is there any level of mercury that's safe? And generally, there's no level of mercury that's really safe, although we it's very difficult not to be exposed to some mercury because fish is a very important food source. So one of the sources of mercury that everybody should be aware of is coal. So coal has some mercury in it, so coal-fired plants will produce mercury. And that's been one of the issues in Washington State and the Northwest, is they want to ship a lot of coal to China. When that coal is burned in China, the prevailing winds move the effluent from those smokestacks, which contains mercury, in the Pacific Ocean and into the Northwest United States, which contaminates our water supplies with mercury, and the fish and wildlife become sources of mercury. So mercury causes neurodevelopmental disorders. It's a well-known neurotoxicant. Or inorganic mercury is like the Mad Hatter. So you remember the Mad Hatter?
Yes.
And that's a great story. That it was used in the felting, the hatting industry, and their exposure to mercury there.
I'm trying to remember, don't they like lick the brushes, and that's how they were doing, getting the mercury, because they licked the brushes? Maybe I'm thinking of something else.
Well, but yeah, anyway. It was mostly from vapor, so the mercury would evaporate and be exposed to them that way, so inhaling the mercury. You're thinking of paint and licking the paints. Radium dial watches were well known for that because people that were painting the dials on watches would be exposed to radium, which is toxic and bone-seeking compound.
And also, did you know that Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart died from mercury poisoning?
Yeah, I've heard that. Yeah, there's some thoughts about that, which is possible. There's also a couple Chinese emperors that died from mercury exposure, too. It seems they're taking mercury tablets. Because mercury's been used as a medicine for a long time, as for syphilis and for other diseases. And it also shows up in cosmetics, because it's a great fungicide. You might know that some vaccines will have mercury in organic mercury in vaccines. There's been a lot of concern about that potentially contributing to autism, although I think most of the data is not supporting that. But, you know, that's another issue, because we're exposed to mercury from a variety of products and sources.
Well, I can tell you that I do occasionally drink coffee. I do not eat fish or any kind of seafood.
So seafood is really good. It's got omega-3 fatty acids in it. Yeah. I think it's more looking at which fish you eat. Like salmon, for example, has spent a lot of time in the ocean, but are relatively short-lived. It's a longer-lived fish that you really have to worry about mercury exposure in them, like tuna, swordfish, pike, you know, that are longer-lived fish that consume other fish they really have to worry about. But fish has got a lot of important nutrients in it.
I agree. But, you know, ever since I was a child and I took my first bite of fish, which happened to be halibut, I've never wanted to eat a seafood. It's just like I put it in my mouth and I go, oh, I don't want this. And I know that some people just love seafood and think it's the most delicious thing in the world, and it just isn't for me. I just pay attention to the fact that my body doesn't want it.
Well, that's important to do.
Yeah.
And I think that, again, it's the developing nervous system that's most vulnerable to mercury exposure. So it's, you know, women of childbearing age and the developing nervous system of kids that are most vulnerable to mercury exposure.
Good. So we only have...
Actually, one more thought on that. So the EPA is actually looking at revising that, and there's a number of studies looking at the amount of fish that are consumed, because high fish consumers are more vulnerable to mercury exposure. So the EPA is looking at changing its recommendations how much mercury is safe to consume.
Good.
It'll be very interesting to see in the next year or so.
Yeah, good. Well, Dr. Gilbert, we only have a few minutes left. So is there anything that you want to make sure that you say in this show before you have about, we have about 4 minutes left?
The thing I would like, one quick thing about lead is you have to be careful of lead in drinking water. So you have to watch out for that. Old homes have lead-based pipes that bring water into the home. And even some schools, some of the older schools, can have lead in the drinking water. So just watch out for that. And I think the other thing I just want to mention is we need to take a more precautionary approach to chemicals we're exposed to. You know, the precautionary principle, you know, says that we need to look at the uncertainty but not focus on the uncertainty, that we need to take a precautionary approach and reduce exposure to these chemicals. With the Food and Drug Administration, we put new drugs on the market. We take a very precautionary approach, requiring that that chemicals, our data be submitted from the pharmaceutical and biotechnology industries, demonstrating safety and efficacy of the products. We do not have a similar approach to industrial chemicals. And that's, I think, really something that needs to change. They're trying to modify the Toxic Substance Control Act, which is an old law passed in 1976, to really adjust that and provide more data on chemicals and the potential hazards of industrial-based chemicals that we're exposed to.
I think that's really important. I've been thinking, one of the things that I've noticed, because I've been doing this work a long time like you have, is that I've seen things change over the years in terms of the general awareness of the society, but also the information that has become available, that there's so much more information about the toxicity of products than there was 30 years ago. And so I now see many more individuals and agencies and organizations saying, well, we need to do something about these toxic chemicals. And then what happens is that a list is put together of chemicals of concern, and then it all has to be supported by scientific data. Now, I think that that's all a good thing to do. I'm not against science by any means. But as a consumer advocate and somebody who's trying to avoid chemicals in my daily life, it seems to me like that there are some things that are obvious, like that organic food without pesticides is better for you than food with pesticides sprayed on it. Yeah. I think that there's ample enough evidence to know that we shouldn't be consuming pesticides, and yet that still continues. And what do you think needs to happen in order for us to stop like trying to prove how toxic various chemicals are and just like make that leap out of them entirely? That's what I would like.
I totally agree with you, and that's why I really emphasize we need a more precautionary approach and, you know, more emphasis on the precautionary principle, because we have all this information. And that's one thing I try to do with my website is, you know, we have tremendous amounts of knowledge. The issue is applying it and making the information accessible. We need to know what is in our products and what we're being exposed to. You know, caffeine's a great example of that. It might be listed as an ingredient, but you don't know how much is in the beverage that you're consuming. And it can be fatal. There's been a couple incidents where people consuming high caffeine-containing beverages have died. So we really need to have a better approach to chemicals in the environment, where the burden of proof is not for the consumer to demonstrate harm, but the industry has to have the burden of demonstrating and showing safety. You know, bisphenol A is a great example of that, where you secrete a little bit of bisphenol A in the urine, and nobody gave permission to be exposed to these compounds.
No, we haven't, and I haven't, and I don't want to be exposed to them. And yet, I think that, well, we're going to run out of time in about less than a minute, but I just want to close with this statement, and we're going to have a lot more time to talk, Dr. Gilbert. What I wanted to say is that I think what needs to happen is that there needs to be a lot better labeling, so that we know there needs to be disclosure, there needs to be labeling, so that consumers really know what's in the product and we can make informed choices. Thank
Absolutely.
You so much. Yeah,
better rules.
Yeah, yeah. And I want to work on that a lot more coming up. So thank you so much for being on, Dr. Gilbert. We're going to have you back very soon.
Great. Thank you very much.
And we'll talk more.
Thanks. It's really great.
You're welcome. And I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd. This is Toxic Free Talk Radio. And go to ToxicFreeTalkRadio.com to find out who else is going to be on this week.